Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. Perry Allen Carr, or Pie, as friends and family called him, a 44-year-old mine worker living in Alturas, Florida, arrived home on a hot and muggy day in June of 1988. He checked the mailbox and found a note addressed to him. When he opened the envelope, he found a yellow post-it note with a typed message on it. It read, "You and all your so-called family have 2 weeks to move out, or you will all die. This is no joke." Thinking it was a prank, Pye showed it to just two people, his stepson Dwayne and his friend, Minister Robert Grant. Neither of them could imagine anyone wanting to hurt the Carr family and told him to ignore it. Pye took their advice and forgot about the note. He had recently married Peggy Carr, a 41-year-old waitress, and they had combined their two households. The two sets of children were not getting along, and frankly, his marriage, after only a couple of months, was in trouble. So he had plenty going on that distracted him. He didn't think of the note again until a few months later, after his wife Peggy, his son Travis, and his stepson Dwayne fell ill with the mysterious malady that was slowly and painfully killing them. When it was discovered that the cause was a rare poison, it was too late to save Peggy. Travis was partially paralyzed for life, and Dwayne would never be the same. That yellow post-it note was no longer a joke. It was now one of the main clues that helped solve the mystery of who poisoned the Carrs. As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is Killer Psyche. I've spent 5 decades studying people's minds. Through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse, I've interviewed lots of murderers, including serial killers, and the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. It's difficult to get a satisfying answer without diving deep into their mindsets. So that's what we're doing, and I will give you my best analysis in this series of what made them do what they did. This episode is George Trepal, the Mensa murderer. October 23rd, 1988 started out as a normal day for Peggy Carr. She had the early shift at the restaurant where she worked with her daughter. It wasn't until late that afternoon that she first began to feel ill. Her fingers and toes began to tingle painfully, and she became very nauseated. She then developed pain in her chest and extremities and had difficulty breathing. By the evening, she could not speak. In fact, she couldn't even open her eyes. Peggy was taken to the hospital, where she was admitted. After several days, both Peggy and the doctors were confused and frustrated. The doctors could find nothing wrong, meaning they had no explanation for her symptoms, and they wondered if it was a psychological issue. You know, all in her head. When it appeared that her symptoms had improved, they released her. However, the symptoms soon returned, and this time they were even worse. The only thing she could say is that her legs and feet were killing her. As Peggy was rushed back to the hospital, her son, Dwayne, and her stepson, Travis, also began to feel excruciating pain in their legs and feet. After they too were rushed to the hospital, it was clear that there was something very real affecting the Carr family, and it was not in Peggy's head. The doctors considered that they had all been poisoned, but they tested negative for every poison that the doctors came up with. It was not until Peggy's hair started falling out in clumps that the attending neurologist suspected a very rare poison that they had not been tested for, thallium. He immediately ordered tests on Peggy and the two boys. The results confirmed his theory. Thallium is a soft, malleable gray metal that was previously used in rat poisons and insecticides until the EPA banned its use in 1972. It is classified as a heavy metal, such as mercury, arsenic, and lead. Thallium and its compounds are especially dangerous because compounds containing thallium are colorless, odorless, and tasteless. And back then, it was not included on standard poison screening tests. And the sale of thallium was greatly restricted even within the chemical and pharmaceutical industries due to its extreme toxicity. You should not even handle thallium unless trained to do so. To give you an idea of the toxicity of thallium sulfate, a single teaspoon of thallium, about 34 grams, would be capable of killing 34 people. So only 1 gram of thallium could kill a person. The boys were now also losing their hair, and Travis was on a respirator. Peggy had ingested double the amount of the poison that the boys did. She lost all ability to communicate and slipped into a coma. There was nothing that could be done for her. After the hospital alerted the sheriff's office about a possible criminal poisoning, detectives combed the Carr's house but could not find a trace of the toxin. Authorities even tested the well water that fed the Carr property, but it came back negative. It didn't take too much longer for investigators to uncover the source of the thallium, an 8-pack of 16-ounce glass Coca-Cola bottles under the kitchen sink in the Carr's home. Because of the possibility of product tampering, the FBI was called in. After testing other bottles in that shipment and eliminating the possibility of a nationwide tampering, detectives realized that this had been a targeted attack. They started with the obvious suspect, Peggy's husband, Pye. They heard that there had been some trouble in the new marriage, and Peggy suspected Pye of cheating on her. However, they soon discarded any suspicion of Pye after lab results confirmed that traces of thallium were found in him, Peggy's daughter Galena, and her granddaughter Casey as well. Then Pye gave investigators their first strong lead, the yellow Post-it note. Apart from misspelling Pye's name, the envelope had correctly listed Pye's mailing address as being in Barstow. Only someone who lived in the area would have known that even though the Carrs lived in Alturas, they got their mail on the Barstow post office route. On March 3, 1989, after 3 months in a coma, Peggy Carr's family took her off life support, and mercifully, she died. There was no cure or ability to reverse the effects of her poisoning. The case was now officially considered a homicide investigation. When asked if there was anyone they had a problem with, Pye could only think of one couple that they'd had a minor squabble with, their next-door neighbors. George Trepal, an eccentric computer programmer, and his wife, orthopedic surgeon Dr. Diana Carr, no relation to Pye. Trepal had a long history of complaints about Pye's noisy children and dogs. Dogs that, by the way, died in 1984 and another one in 1985 of a mysterious illness. George despised their loud auto engines, stereos, and had a particular animosity for their ATVs, which the teenagers sometimes drove onto his property. In fact, only days before Peggy fell ill, his wife and Peggy had a verbal altercation in the car's driveway over the teenagers' loud music. When Trepal was first interviewed by detectives, they noted his lack of empathy. What struck detectives the most was his response when asked why someone would poison the Carrs. They had asked that of everyone they'd interviewed, and Trepal was the first to give them an answer. George's answer was that maybe it was to get them to move out of their house. His response struck the investigators as eerily similar to the threatening post-it note mailed to Pye in June. That made investigators turn their focus on George Trepal and his wife, Diana Carr. The police were looking for an opportunity to develop insight into this aloof couple, and soon one presented itself. George and his wife would host murder mystery weekends, and George would write the script. Just a few weeks after Peggy's death, George and Diana announced in the local paper that they would be hosting a party that weekend. The detective sent an undercover agent, Susan Gorek, to the party. Ironically, the murder that was staged that night was the story of a detailed voodoo poisoning. The game had four murders, and each of the four was preceded by the victim receiving a threatening note. Trepal himself wrote a fake voodoo booklet given to the players. The book covered a variety of situations, including poisoning and threats by neighbors. It stated, quote, "Few voodooists believe they can be killed by psychic means, but no one doubts that he can be poisoned. When a death threat appears on the doorstep, prudent people throw out all their food and watch what they eat. Hardly anyone dies from magic. Most items on the doorstep are just a neighbor's way of saying, I don't like you, move or else." That really wasn't a very subtle clue, George. In fact, I take it as a confession. The undercover agent, under the name of Sherry Gwynn, became friendly with George. She presented herself as a Houston woman fleeing from an abusive husband. When George and his wife decided to move to Sebring, Florida, they rented their house out to Sherry. Sherry, then being the legal resident of the home, let the crime scene investigators come in and test everything. The crime lab found traces of thallium in a bottle in George's garage, as well as books about homemade poisoning, and chemistry books and equipment. There was also George's homemade journal about poison and poison detection in organs. Another piece of evidence that they thought was interesting: a copy of the Agatha Christie novel, The Pale Horse, where the victims are killed with thallium, presenting it as the perfect poison for murder. With this evidence, as well as statements given to the undercover detective that exposed George's knowledge of the crimes that had not been released to the public, the cops knew they had their killer. On April 5, 1990, George Trepel was arrested and indicted on one count of first-degree murder, six counts of attempted first-degree murder, seven counts of poisoning food or water, and one count of tampering with a consumer product. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital on sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche. George Trepel was born on January 23, 1949, in New York City. His father was a policeman and his mother a schoolteacher. George studied psychology at Clemson University in South Carolina and later studied chemistry at Piedmont College in North Carolina. George didn't really like school, didn't think it was for him, but he did like being a chemist. In 1975, he was arrested and served 2.5 years in federal prison for his part in one of the largest methamphetamine manufacturing operations in North Carolina. By the way, did I mention that thallium nitrate can also be used to make methamphetamine? After George was released from prison, he met Diana Carr at a Georgia Mensa chapter meeting while she was completing her medical residency. Mensa is an organization of people with high IQs. It was founded by two Englishmen in 1946 in order to gather brain power for national emergencies, but it has turned into a social club that every so often turns its attention to socially relevant issues. According to Mensa International, IQ is a type of standard score that indicates how far above or how far below his or her peer group and individual stands in mental ability. Psychologist William Stern coined the term IQ, which stands for intelligence quotient, in 1912. At that time, IQ was factored by the ratio of mental age to chronological age times 100. So, if an individual of 10 years of age had a mental age of 10, their IQ would be 100. However, if their mental age was greater than their chronological age, their IQ would be higher. The most standard IQ tests are the Stanford-Binet and the Cattell. The average score on an IQ test is 100. most people fall within the 85 to 114 range. Any score over 140 is considered a high IQ. A score over 160 is considered a genius IQ. And there is only one genius per every million people on Earth. To qualify for Mensa and become what they call a Mensans, you must score in the top 2%. This means a score of 132 or more on the Stanford-Binet test, or 148 or more on the Cattell test. George was very proud of being in Mensa. He and Diana rarely socialized outside of local Mensa chapter gatherings. George was known to be a bit odd and somewhat of a recluse, but this seemed to be a group that he thrived within. However, a study published in the 2017 journal Intelligence noted that superior IQs are sometimes associated with psychological and physiological disorders. The study surveyed Mensa's members with an IQ of 132 or higher and found that they were more likely to suffer from a range of both types of disorders. An article in Scientific American reports that the survey covered mood disorders, depression, dysthymia, bipolar, anxiety disorders, generalized social and obsessive compulsive disorders, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and autism. Participants were also asked if they had ever been formally diagnosed with any disorder or if they themselves suspected that they suffered from it. The study goes on to further state that the biggest differences between the Mensa group and the general population were seen for mood disorders and anxiety disorders. More than a quarter, to be specific, 26.7%, of the participants reported that they had been formally diagnosed with a mood disorder, while 20% reported an anxiety disorder, far higher than the national averages of around 10% for each. The study proposed a theory to explain these findings called the hyperbrain-hyperbody theory. This says that even though there are many advantages with being highly intelligent, that it is also associated with psychological and physiological overexcitabilities, also known as OEs. This is a concept that psychiatrist and psychologist Kazimierz Dąbrowski introduced in the 1960s. OEs are an intense reaction, unusually out of proportion to an environmental threat. This applies to everything from a loud sound to a confrontation with another person, or an insult. We see an example of this when looking at an interaction between George and the cars. He would become infuriated with anything he considered a disruption to his routine or environment. Of course, we need to be careful when looking at the results of this study. Just because a disorder seems to be more common in a sample of people in a survey, that doesn't prove that high intelligence is the cause of the disorder. It could also just be that the people that join Mensa are different than just people with high IQs. Also, being smart certainly didn't protect George from making mistakes. George planned his crime so meticulously, but did not seem to think through the aftermath or how to avoid detection. A crime is not a perfect crime unless you get away with it. The obviousness of the murder mystery theme, the compilation of books and journals on poisoning, the bottle with traces of thallium, and let's not forget, renting his house out to an undercover agent. Well, those were certainly not the most intelligent things to do. Even if we give George a pass on renting his home to Susan Gorick, the undercover agent, we need to think about his gullibility level and that he rented out his house and then left evidence there that linked him to the crimes. Why didn't he get rid of the evidence before renting his home? Probably because he didn't think he would get caught. When someone, in particular a narcissist, believes that he is smarter than everyone else, he does not believe that anyone would be able to outsmart him. George was a narcissist who also thought nothing of taking another person's life in an excruciatingly painful way just because they annoyed him. That's not only narcissistic behavior, but it's also psychopathic. He didn't care who got poisoned, and he's never expressed remorse. And we know that characteristic definitely describes a psychopath. George was the worst kind of combination for a killer. He was a narcissistic psychopath. We've discussed that in other episodes on killer psyche. He was a psychopath because he felt no remorse and had no empathy. He was narcissistic because he thought he was smarter than anyone else in the room. Poisoners frequently have narcissistic personality disorder. They believe that they are special and unique, superior to pretty much everybody else, just like George did about his intelligence, and they have a sense of entitlement. We've spoken about this disorder in many episodes of Killer Psyche, and it definitely is a common theme in many different types of killers. When you think about it, it makes sense. A narcissist doesn't think they're going to get caught. If they did, they would never commit a murder. When the investigators searched George and Diana's new home in Sebring, Florida, they found a hidden torture-type room filled with S&M paraphernalia, videos, and over 60 books on the subject. We cannot know the exact usage of these objects, but here's something I think is very interesting about George. He was not confrontational. George avoided face-to-face confrontations, as do most poisoners. Diana was the one who would fight with the Carrs. She actually went on their property to complain about them. She had a horrible reputation as a rude and angry woman who would bully her staff, while George was known to be submissive and weak. In fact, when Susan, the undercover agent, staged an argument with her fake ex-husband, George apparently ran away from them. Special Agent Bill Hagmeier, a profiler at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, created the profile of the unknown killer in this case. This is what he said. Look for a person who might do something like this, doesn't have the intestinal fortitude to deal with situations directly. He deals with conflict in a cowardly way. So, what is the psychological profile of a poisoner? They believe they are superior to others. They have a scorn for authority and a strong need for control. Or should I say, to control. Not surprisingly, they tend to be highly narcissistic. As criminals go, they tend to be on the brighter side, as this type of crime requires a lot of planning. First, they have to study the poison and they have to learn about the effects of dosing. What dose will cause a quick death and what dose will cause a slow and torturous one? And most importantly, how to handle the poison without accidentally killing themselves. It's a widely regarded myth that poisoning is a female killer's method of choice. In fact, male poisoners outnumber females as a group, and overwhelmingly so when the victim is a woman. Career-wise, healthcare professionals and caretaking positions such as wife or mother are overrepresented in the poisoners group. Most poisoners kill someone they know, a spouse, child, a friend, a neighbor, or an acquaintance. They have access to and power and control over their victims. These types of killers are called power and control poisoners. Access is very important in this crime. The killer must have access to his victim, or in the Carrs case, victims. And George did. According to the research of Christopher Cordes, that was published in the Journal of Forensic Psychiatry in 2008. And I quote, "There appears to be a great need for the feeling of power which poison imparts and which the generalized response of terror partly satisfies." This type of killer tends to poison compulsively. Once is not enough. Historically, we've seen many female poisoners not only kill their spouse, but their stepchildren, then their own children. Then when that supply of victims is gone, they expand their hunting grounds to neighbors, visitors, etc. This tends to not happen now to the degree that it did decades ago, because we are so much more knowledgeable now about this type of criminal behavior. If we see two, three people dying in a household, including the elderly and the very young, the very first thing that should come to someone's mind is, somebody here is poisoning these people. However, if the poisoner gets away with it the first time, and many of them do, that success, as they call it, tends to increase their confidence, and they'll do it again. Because they got away with it, like any other crime, their behavior, in this case poisoning someone, is reinforced and therefore becomes habitual. Behavior occurs because it is reinforced. Behavior that is not reinforced gradually diminishes and becomes extinct. In psychologist Joni Johnston's article in the June 2012 issue of Psychology Today, The Psychological Profile of a Poisoner, she says, quote, "Killing someone by poison, by its very nature, requires careful planning and subterfuge. So it should come as no surprise that they can design a murder plan in as much detail as if they were writing the script of a play." Sound familiar? She adds that, male or female, they tend to avoid physical confrontation and instead rely on verbal and emotional manipulation to get what they want from others. Meaning, they could be straight, but they choose to be crooked in the way they go about dealing with other people. As for the poisoner's motives, they are not much different from other homicides, meaning greed or personal gain, revenge or getting even for being wronged or if they perceive they were wrong, and finally, jealousy. These are the top bell ringers that drive a poisoner to kill. Johnston goes on to say that because 1 in 5 verified murders by poisoning is never solved, it's hard to draw a definitive profile of the typical poisoner. But those that have been caught and convicted do reveal some clues into their psyche. They are clever, sneaky, emotionally immature, methodical, and self-centered. Many of them are highly skilled at pretending to be a caring nurse, a doting spouse, or devoted friend. But behind the mask lies a psyche that is propelled by childish needs and unencumbered by moral restraint. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a perfect description of George Trepow. We have many reports on how passive-aggressive George could be. Passive-aggressive behavior comes from a person not being able to or not wanting to directly express feelings of hostility, frustration, or even deep anger. Passive-aggressive people act out in a way to express their discontent without actually vocalizing it. And in a way, that allows them to deny any responsibility for the act. Kind of like, who, me? I wouldn't do anything like that. I mean, when you think about it, if a person is filled with anger, resentment, or jealousy towards another person and they don't deal with those feelings in a mature and acceptable manner, what's going to happen to all that negative emotion? I can assure you, it will come out one way or the other, and the victim of it will never see it coming. One of the telltale signs of a passive-aggressive person is that they are an underachiever, that they are not living up to their potential. There's no denying George was very smart, and with his chemistry background, he had a lot of choices he could have made. Instead, he worked in a meth lab and went to prison for it. He was later a computer programmer, but oddly, he had no clients. According to an article Signe Whitson wrote in Psychology Today, the passive-aggressive person believes life will only get worse if other people know of their anger. So he expresses his feelings indirectly using a variety of behaviors to subtly get back at another person. While anger itself is generally experienced as an uncomfortable emotion, the passive-aggressive person derives genuine pleasure out of frustrating others. We know that George would frequently do things that undermine the cars. For example, when Pi and Peggy were remodeling their garage, George was angry at the noise and mess that was happening next door. So George reported them to the zoning commission. This cost Pi a lot of money and time. I have no doubt at all that once the cars had trouble with the commission, George couldn't get the radiant smile he had off his face. But George's passive aggression played out in other ways that were far more dangerous. He was exceedingly paranoid, and during college, he experimented with a lot of recreational drugs. According to an article by Delaney Bartlett, when he was in college, he was convinced that people were coming into his room uninvited, so he coated his doorknob with hallucinogens designed to be absorbed into the skin to teach the trespassers a lesson. Another time, while he was on a road trip with a friend, they would pick up unsuspecting hitchhikers and give them brownies or cookies laced with drugs just to witness their reactions. Both of those things are felonies. So it seems that George's method of silent aggression, poisoning, had very early roots. Poisoning someone is also a passive-aggressive way to murder them. A poisoner can kill someone that is stronger than them or even smarter than them and not risk being in any physical danger. Poisoners are generally non-confrontational, as we've mentioned, and George Trepal is a prime example. Being passive-aggressive is not necessarily a common trait among all killers, but it definitely is among poisoners. Most poisoners feel superior to their victims. That is true of George Trepal. He considered the cars to be dumb, since he had sent them a warning to move or they would be killed, and they ignored it. But it was that very note that pointed the investigators in the right direction, right to him. Though a once popular method, poison is not often used to murder anymore. A 2015 article in the Washington Post stated, it is used in just under 0.5% of murders. That's using a definition of poisoning that includes standard poisons and also narcotics or sleeping pills. We talked about poisoners on Killer Psyche in the Tylenol murders episode, and George Trepal shares many of the same traits that the killer in that case had. Their crimes were similar in that neither killer, neither poisoner could have known who would consume the poison. They're also similar in that in the Tylenol murders, it was a mass murder. 7 people died in a week from ingesting Tylenol. In the case of the cars, there was enough poison in those Coca-Cola bottles to kill the whole family. 5 of the 6 people living in that house ingested the poison, but the potential was there for the entire Carr family to be murdered. Most poisoners are said to be sneaky, cunning, and creative. Their murders are very well planned out, down to the last detail. For George to break into the Carr's house and replace their Coca-Cola bottles means that he must have been watching them to learn their habits. And get this, he also had a tool that crime scene investigators found in his garage that could actually take off bottle caps and then reseal them. If that's not sneaky, I don't know what is. And as I pointed out earlier, he chose a poison that is not well known and that doctors rarely screen for. Poisoners are generally developmentally stunted, and they view other people without any empathy. This is how detectives describe George Trepal. George had no idea when his poisons would take effect. It was almost as if he were setting a ticking time bomb in the car's house, but had no idea how long the timer was for.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
I think George was also a sadist. I say this because the amount of poison that he used on the cars did not ensure a quick death. It ensured a slow, agonizing one. He could have used something that would have killed them quickly with minimal pain, but instead, he used a poison in a low enough dose that allowed him to imagine that the victims, whoever they might be, were suffering. And George knew there was no antidote to thallium back then, once the blood levels had reached a certain point. For some people, it's hard to reconcile that George, who presented himself as meek and quiet, could be the evil mastermind that killed Peggy Carr. But that describes a lot of people who murder by poison. George may have been clever enough to pull off the crime, but he wasn't smart enough to get away with it. Or perhaps he had the smarts to get away with it, but his narcissism got in the way. George Trepel's trial lasted a month. The prosecution introduced over 70 witnesses that testified to his guilt. He maintained his innocence and refused a plea deal that would have kept the death penalty off the table. In February of 1991, George was convicted of the murder of Peggy Carr. The jury deliberated for 6 hours and found him guilty of one count of first-degree murder, 6 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 7 counts of poisoning food or water with the intent to kill, and 1 count of tampering with a consumer product. However, it only took the jury 1 hour to deliberate when they recommended the death penalty. On March 6, 1991, George Trepel was sentenced to death. He has filed numerous appeals, and all of them have been denied. His wife, Diana, divorced him in 1996 and then died in 2018 from complications of a stroke. Pi Carr passed away in 2020. And yet, George Trepel, 72 years old, is still alive, 30 years after his death sentence. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. Next week on Killer Psyche, I'll be covering Winnie Ruth Judd, the suitcase killer. If you don't want to wait, you can listen to it right now and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Edited by Joshua Morales with Maxwell Carney. Our senior audio producer is Tom Monahan. Brandon Clark and Lindsay Whistler are our production assistants, and the line producer is Oscar Guido. Our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Trefort, and Marshall Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. This series is produced by Wondery and Trefort Media.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.